the Labor, Industry and Veterans and Military Affairs, Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund is present. Representative Zhang excused. Representative Detmer. Representative McDonald.
McDonald present.
Representative McDonald present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Bliss present. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Edelson present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Frederick present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Nelson present. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Poston present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Raleigh present. Representative Sundin. And Mr. President. Chair, Representative Sundin present. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Quorum is present. Next on the agenda is the meeting minutes. Representative Poston, did you happen to check out the meeting minutes?
Chair, I haven't. Chair, I have, and I'd like to move those minutes.
Representative Poston moves the minutes from March 2nd, 2022. Any questions, additions, or deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Minutes are adopted. Members, we have one bill and one presentation on the agenda today. The first bill is from Majority Leader Winkler, House File 3405. I move that House File 3405 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And members, we have about 30 minutes blocked for this bill so we can have enough time for Commissioner Robertson. Welcome, Majority Leader Winkler. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time today to discuss House File 3405. This is an old idea applied to a new context. The original concept behind a worker committee like this came out of the Great Depression, a time when the need to find innovative ways to allow working people in this country to have a say in the working conditions in their job site, to advocate for better pay and benefits, and to do so in coordination and negotiation with employers was highly important. It's highly important again today. The bill that I'm presenting today is in the context of the long-term care industry, but it could be just as easily applied in the context of the fast food industry or any other service industry where workers have challenges in organizing themselves into a union, where wages have been historically low, and where we have a severe workforce issue in front of us. I will acknowledge on the very front end that this industry is highly regulated today in terms of health and safety, the kinds of payments it can receive, the ways in which it operates. It is also true that with 80% of the funds supporting long-term care coming from public sources, that the public has a great interest in the way that this industry is run and how workers are treated. We cannot have a successful long-term care industry without adequate state funding to provide the facilities, the workforce, the medical care, and all of the requirements for a successful long-term care sector. But we also can't do it without the workers. We not only people who are willing to show up and care for our elders and care for our family members who need help, but also people who are dedicated to their work, who are invested in their work, who believe and have relationships with the people that they're serving. And by creating a board of this type and giving it the powers that it has, we create an opportunity for workers to be invested in the working conditions of their workforce and in their workplace. So the construct here is a little unusual, and I think it takes a minute just to really understand how this works. So under labor law, as this committee I'm sure knows, we have federal rules that govern through the National Labor Relations Act. We also have public employees under PELRA in Minnesota. So private sector labor, general labor is at the national level, and all NLRA. The public sector at the state and local level is governed by a state PELRA law. And anybody who is a member of a union and subject to those processes have an opportunity to negotiate in the workplace for wages and working conditions. If you are not part of a union and you are not covered under those laws, then we are in a different situation. And the state has the power to step in a way that is not something that we are used to in this context. But we have the opportunity at the state level to regulate working conditions, to ban things like wage theft, to ban child labor, to establish minimum wages, to establish limits on the work week, hours in the work week. And we do that under state law. There is no reason why the ability of the state to set those conditions of employment in law cannot be delegated to a board, which is what this bill does. It creates a board with the power to set wages, working conditions, and other standards for a particular sector of the economy. So it's an extension of our ability to ban child labor or our ability to set a maximum number of hours per week or to require workers' comp or to require unemployment insurance. We have the power to do it at the state, we can do it by sector, and we can delegate that power to a board. The board that this bill creates is made up of 9 members. Essentially, it is 3 representatives from state government, it is 3 representatives from employers, and it is 3 representatives from workers. And that board has the power and the obligation to investigate conditions in that industry and to set standards for that industry to apply to all the workforce in that industry. We look for ways to increase funding for the long-term care industry. The goal behind this bill is to make sure that workers are invested in the workplace, that workers have a say in the working conditions, and that we are using the power of the state to make sure that workers have a place at the bargaining table, a negotiating position in this industry, as we commit a lot of public funds to support the industry. There are a couple of testifiers, Mr. Chair. We can walk through details in the bill as members might have questions, but that's essentially the goal behind the legislation and how it's structured.
Thank you, Majority Leader Winkler. First testifier, David Madeline, Senior Fellow, Center for American Progress. Mr. Madeline, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name's David Madland. I'm a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. I have long researched workforce standards boards and, in fact, wrote about them in my most recent book. As Majority Leader Winkler noted, a workforce standards board can help address many challenges in the nursing home industry. These challenges include staffing shortages, low wages, poor working conditions, and uneven quality of care. And in doing so, it can benefit all parties, the workers, employers, patients, and the public. So how does a workforce standards board help address these shared problems in the industry? Well, it brings together representatives of workers, employers, and the public to investigate the challenges and make recommendations for minimum standards in the industry. And that means that workers and employers and the public get to bring their experiences and voices into the process, and they wouldn't be able to do so without this kind of a forum. It also means that there's an authority over multiple interrelated issues, training, compensation, working hours, safety, not just a single isolated problem. These issues are interrelated and need to be dealt with more comprehensively. It also facilitates a back and forth discussion over overlapping issues that can enable people to get to the necessary kinds of solutions. And unlike many other commissions, these recommendations carry significant weight and trigger governmental action. And in setting industry-wide standards, they lead to similar pay for similar work, which helps increase productivity and quality in the industry, and also can help close racial and gender pay gaps because similar pay and for similar work. It also, the boards engage the workers and the employers, and this can ensure that standards are actually enforced. Unfortunately, you know, wage theft and other problems are rampant, but when you have workers and employers engaged, you can significantly minimize those problems. It's this tripartite, which means workers, employers, and the public, industry-wide standard setting is a long-standing policy solution, as Majority Leader Winkler noted. In early 1900s, many states had similar kinds of policies, and in fact, the original federal minimum wage law had an industry committee. And it's growing in recent years, it's really growing momentum for recognizing the power of these kind of solutions. Since 2018, four states, New York, Colorado, Michigan, and Nevada, as well as three local governments, Seattle, Philadelphia, and Detroit, have all passed laws creating tripartite industry-wide commissions for one industry or a group of industries. And just to wrap up, because I know we have other testimonies, it's the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board brings together key stakeholders, and it can help solve challenges in the industry and bring workers as well as employers into the process in a way they might not be able otherwise able to. Thank you.
I'm muted. Sorry about that. Thank you, Mr. Madelins. Please stick around for any member questions. Representative Poston, can you wait to the other three testifiers for your question?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. Next up is Julius Nyakundi. And Julius, if I mispronounce your name, I seriously apologize. Nursing Assistant Mission Nursing Home. Mr. Nyakundi, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman Eklund and members of the committee, my name is Julius Nyakundi. I'm a nursing assistant. I work at the Mission Care Center Nursing Home in Plymouth. I live in Andover. I am a steward with the SEIU. Our union represents 50,000 healthy workers. I encourage you to support this bill. It is the only way to overcome our workforce crisis and build the workforce that can handle the next pandemic. I first started working at the Mission Care Center 2004. I've worked there for almost 20 years. Before COVID-19, our mission nursing assistant started at $13.89 an hour. More than a year in the COVID-19 pandemic, the nursing assistant starting wage had only gone up to $14.15 an hour. After more than a year of death, our starting wages were still lower than many fast food places. As a long-term employee, when COVID started, I got a raise of 32 cents. After almost a year of COVID, I got a raise of 35 cents. Those wage increases are not enough to keep staff. Our most recent contract, however, was better, but still I must work extra hours all the time to make ends meet. I always struggle to provide for my five children. Since the COVID-19 pandemic started too many people have left the industry. Half of my friends have quit. Some left, they were afraid of catching COVID-19. Almost half of the people I work with got sick. For months, we had nothing more than surgical masks at the nursing homes. After we got N95 masks, we had to ratio them. Every day I was worried I could bring COVID home to my family. For 2 years, I spent most of my time at home alone in my room. If a fatal illness threatens you and your family, Why risk to so much for a job that pays so little? When my coworkers started looking for other employment, they were surprised to find that other jobs paid so much better. We thought we were doing a critical work, but so many other people made so much more driving trucks or delivering food. When someone finds a better paying job, everybody at work talks about it, and our morale sinks. People feel like they are fools for sticking with the industry. Even worse, working short-staffed takes away the pride I took in my work. My workload is unbearable. Instead of taking care of 10 residents, I'm now caring for 15 or more. We rarely get new workers to replace those that leave. If we do, they don't last. I can't complete the tasks I should. Every day I feel depressed when I end my shift because I know I should have done more. I don't have enough time for important things that matter so much to my residents. I have given 20 years to this industry. The employers have had 20 years or more to build a workforce that could have survived this crisis. We need tens of thousands of new workers. To attract people and to keep them during a crisis, we need an industry-wide minimum wage pay scale that reward experienced workers, affordable health insurance, and even pensions. Workers only get this when they have a seat at the table to set industry standards. Please give us the tools to save this industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nayakundi. Next to testifier is Aaron Hupert, Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota. Mr. Hooper, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. I'm sorry. Ms. Hooper, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Winkler. My name is Erin Hubert, and I am Vice President of Advocacy with Leading Age. And I, along with my colleague, who will introduce himself in a moment, are here today on behalf of a long-term care imperative and our concerns about House File 3405. Members of the committee, I've been in my position about a week. And what has already become abundantly clear to me in that short time is that we do have a very significant workforce challenge in our nursing homes. As you have read in your local newspapers, seen on television or heard on the radio, senior care, especially nursing homes, are struggling to stay afloat. To the extent that this proposal recognizes the need to raise wages for caregivers in nursing homes, we agree. That is why we have a bill that seeks to do exactly that and are looking forward to a hearing to present our solutions. However, that is about the extent of our agreement with this particular proposal. I am going to provide a bit of background on what is currently happening within our nursing homes, and then I will turn it over to my colleague who will talk about some of our financial challenges. First, when it comes to staffing, there are really two challenges that we think about. There are current staffing needs and then future staffing needs. Currently, we have approximately 23,000 open positions, and that is about 20% of our workforce. We have had chronic issues with our workforce, but this has really reached new heights. In fact, in the fall, when we surveyed our members, we were losing approximately 1,500 workers per month. And perhaps equally as daunting are the future needs. We have all heard the state demographer on the aging of our state. We know that senior care will need more workers in the future. According to DEED's data, long-term care is consistently among the future highest needs professions. And when we start at such a workforce deficit, it really makes catching up to future needs seem impossible. The other thing I want to touch on is occupancy. So our staff shortage has contributed to an ongoing steep drop in nursing home occupancy. At first, prior to vaccine availability, the occupancy decline was related to the pandemic. Our average dropped pretty dramatically, around 65%, which was down from the average of 85 to 90%. Because of our ongoing workforce challenges and the inability to admit new residents, occupancy has not been able to rebound. The results of our latest survey show that 75% of nursing homes are limiting admissions. This is not because they don't have open beds. It's because they don't have the staff to provide the care for the people in the beds. As you've heard before, you may see this in terms of hospital backups, the inability to place loved ones, waiting lists, et cetera. But also some entire counties have reported that there is no place for people in the community to get the care that they need, which is clearly an access problem that needs to be fixed. This is not nursing homes saying that we don't want more people to work with us. We very much want to hire and compensate our caregivers to provide access to long-term care to communities across Minnesota. So I will turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Pearson, to take it from here.
Thank you, Ms. Hubert. Toby Pearson, Vice President of Advocacy, Care Providers of Minnesota. Mr. Pearson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. Today, on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, as well as Ms. Hubert said, despite what's been kind of perceived as tons of money going into long-term care and nursing homes specifically, our members really continue to have problems with the lack of funds coming in, as pointed out by Ms. Hubert, exacerbated by decreased occupancy and cash flow caused by increased expenses. For 2 years, we've struggled with this. Workers still use full PPE. They're subject to frequent routine testing. They've been living with it for 2 years, and it's going to go on in the foreseeable future. Providers have spent their reserves. They've maxed out their lines of credits. And as several providers have said to me, we are simply circling the drain. During the latest outbreaks, it wouldn't be unusual for facilities to spend tens of thousands of dollars each week on PPE alone, money they won't receive in their rates for nearly 2 years, pursuant to our reimbursement system. One facility estimated that they were spending over $300,000 per month in overtime, PPE, and testing costs. When we asked our members about cash flow, basically they're surviving on a month-to-month basis. About 40% of nursing homes and assisted living said if they were to miss one payment from this government, meaning elderly waiver or nursing or MA payments, they would have to close and they wouldn't be able to cover their payroll and other expenses. About 20 to 30% said they could make it a month, so they could make it a full month before they would be in that same situation. So you've got 65 to 70% of long-term care for older adults that couldn't make it for more than 1 month if the state missed a single payment. These are severe cash flow shortages that they're facing. What makes nursing homes more unique is the state law of rate equalization. Rate equalization basically says that you can't charge private pay any more than you can charge than what Medicaid pays. Medicaid is set in the statutes. This means that nursing home provider, unlike most businesses, cannot simply raise their rates and charge people more in order to pay more to their employees. So an employer like Target, who can announce that, yep, we're going to move to $24 an hour for all the employees, well, they simply pass that on to everybody else. Or McDonald's, if they raise their wages or hire more folks, again, you pay more for a burger and fries, but they can do that. Or if you're local Casey's and you want to raise wages for their convenience store workers, again, you can pass it on. You're able to, in essence, do what you need to do in order to recruit and retain more folks in your workforce. Nursing homes are competing with Target, fast food, and convenience stores for employees. We don't have the ability to simply raise rates in order to pay people more. The legislature does that. Our members have expressed concerns about this proposal also based on their past history with mandates and payment. Most recently, the rulemaking process for assisted living licensure, where the rulemaking disregarded the fact that by DHS's own admission, their studies of elderly waiver payment rates said that they are well below the cost of care. DHS did not step up and say, oh, wow, we need to raise the EEW rates so that we can impose more of these mandates. MDH did not say, wait, maybe we shouldn't do all these mandates if we're not actually paying for the cost of care. Our system simply doesn't want to cover the cost of care for our elderly. For far too long, the state has chosen not to invest in the care for the elderly. So quite simply, when we're asked, do we need an unelected board with no accountability to determine and mandate that nursing homes need to raise wages? No, we already know that. But the same board can't actually allocate the money to do that. That's a legislative thing. So you could have a board say you need to raise the wages, but there's no way to do it. Or do we need a board to tell us that nursing homes need to hire more people? We've been trying to hire more people for the past 2 years. Do we need to have a board tell us working hours need to change when there's nobody else to come in and work? Well, the frail elderly need the nursing care 24/7. We've been desperately trying to recruit and retain our workforce for the past 2 years. We don't need a board to tell us that we need to do more about it. Ultimately, it appears that this proposal is seeking to allow negotiations of several terms of a statewide contract with no accountability for what happens if it diminishes access, meaning it closes a bunch of nursing homes, no ability to pay for the terms they determine if they say you should pay more, and potentially this is a recipe for disaster for access to the seniors who we serve. Minnesota deserves better than this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Member questions. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. My question is for the Majority Leader. Majority Leader Winkler, I have got a nursing home in my district that is actually a county-owned nursing home. And to use Mr. Pearson's term, it is circling the drain. They cannot keep their head above water the way things are today. And I'm wondering if this, number one, is this board going to cost them more money? Is it going to increase their overhead to have this board in place? That's my first question. The other thing I just want to, this is more of a comment. I go to the nursing home on a pretty regular basis before COVID. They let me come and call bingo about once a month, which is awesome. And when I talk to the people that work there, they make so much less than a nurse in a clinic or a hospital. Their benefits are so much less than a nurse in a clinic or a hospital. You know, I don't know what keeps them there other than their love and their passion for those old folks, because they're so underpaid in comparison, and there's some way we have to do something about that. But Majority Leader Winkler, is this gonna add to their overhead cost?
Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, the existence of the board itself does not add to their overhead costs. What this bill would do would create an opportunity for workers and employers to negotiate and to investigate what labor standards should be in the industry. And then have the power to enforce that. So it is not, there's no automatic triggering of higher costs. And I fully agree with what you've said, Representative Poston, Mr. Pearson's testimony, and testimony of Ms. Hubert, who also, by the way, is an outstanding former legislative staffer. We agree. We need significantly more funding in order to make this system work. What this bill represents is an opportunity for workers to have a seat at the table in negotiating out what conditions should be like as we invest more money in the industry, or as we should invest more money in this industry.
Thank you, Majority Leader Winkler, and thank you, Chair Eklund. Appreciate it.
Representative Bliss. Representative Bliss, you're muted.
Sorry. Yep, there we go. I got it back now. So I guess my question on this bill is, Representative Winkler, you made mention early on in your testimony that this is similar to fast food restaurants and food service, and I don't know, you listed a few others. Is it your intention to force unionization and on all those other industries as well as the this industry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, I don't this bill does not force unionization on anybody. It creates a board to set standards for an industry through negotiation and doesn't require any kind of union membership in order to be part of it. As much as I think union membership in the private sector is one of the best ways to address a whole series of social ills that affect every part of the state, this bill doesn't do that. What I was referring to is that this could be applied, this same model could be applied in other industries, not just long-term care.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it is your intention that this could be easily transferred to other industries. Representative Winkler, Representative Poston asked a question if this would add to the overhead of his long-term care facilities. And I, too, have several in my district that are probably circling the drain. And you said, no, the board doesn't, but they could have enforcement capabilities on their recommendations. So while the board adds no overhead to the long-term care facilities, their recommendations certainly do. And I guess, you know, Mr. Chair, this is just another example of you know, using a statewide hammer to fix a few problems. And you know, while I am 100% on board with Representative Poston, you know, we need to increase the funding to these places. And if that's what needs to happen, I'd be happy to support a bill like this. Like that. Unfortunately, I will not be supporting this bill. Thank you.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, Majority Leader Winkler, this is might be slightly redundant to the last question, but you stated that the board will have the authority to enforce the rules. And can you walk us through what that process is of the enforcement side of the rules? And then I'll have a follow-up to one of the rules that could be made. Thank you.
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, it's the authority to enforce labor standards exists currently with the Department of Labor and Industry. This board would have the same level of enforcement power. And there's also a private right of action permitted so that if your rights under this board's rules are violated, you can sue for enforcement, which is the same as we have for the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And on page 10, it says, it shall be unlawful for a nursing home employer to employ a nursing home worker for lower wages or for longer hours than those established as the minimum nursing home employment standards or under other working conditions that violate the minimum nursing home employment standards. One of the problems that I've been hearing from the nursing homes that are in my area and just slightly outside of my districts is their inability to get workers because of, you know, shortages and a lot of other market pressures that are happening right now. If an employee were to take a second shift or an additional shift in order to help out the nursing home and the people that are there, and they went over the amount of time, aren't they going to be in violation of this law if they're just trying to backfill for overtime, Mr. Chair?
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, that depends on the standards established by this board, which will be negotiated between employers, employees, and three officials from the state. So there are no rules, working conditions set in the statute. It's a decision made by this board.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation. This board looks like it's yet another appointed board as opposed to an elected board. Do you foresee, Majority Leader, do you foresee this board having any taxation or revenue generating ability, either at the beginning or the onset or any point after its formation.
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brawley, no. The concept here is that we are setting workplace standards through negotiation between employers and employees in the industry. Of course, state funding for nursing homes is critical for their operating success, but this board would not have that separate power. That would be done through the legislature. And in similar way to state contracts, the conditions that are bargained for, negotiated, they're not bargained for, but negotiated in this board potentially, have to be done within the range of the resources available to the industry. They can't, you can't negotiate or set standards for money that doesn't exist.
Representative Rawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just kind of summing all that up, this board will be able to set standards that organizations that are not unionized, because you said you don't have to be in a union in order to be here or to be within the purview of this board. The board would set the standard, and a nursing home may fall outside of that with the standards that are set by this board. I worry about the mechanics of how this is working. So I'll study it more, and I'm worried about how this is, how the enforcement piece of it is going to be put when we have a labor shortage, and you know these nursing homes are doing everything they can to try to figure it out. So this, again, I'm going to echo what was said previously. This feels like a very large hammer for a precise issue that we're trying to fix. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, in your opening comment, you mentioned that this industry is highly regulated today with its safety and its wages, and that certainly is the truth. And your bill, if you truly wanted to help the worker in securing more wages, desperately needed, it seems to me that since you have your expertise in the legislature little bit longer than I, that we know that rate reimbursement, really, we need to get that legislation passed. We need to allow the nursing homes to be able to increase their rates on those that are not on Medicare, and therefore that will establish the wages that we want so desperately for our workers. I don't think that this board is necessary. You said so yourself, that it's a very highly regulated industry. OSHA and DALI will look into any non-compliance issues or any safety issues already without this board. Matter of fact, they're probably even better qualified because they've been around for many years and really worked very hard in fine-tuning what's best for workers in most industries, including this industry, which again, as you know very, very well, that is highly regulated. So if we really wanna care about the workers and make sure that they're paid well and doing the work that I know that, and I hope you believe too, is God's work, then we need to get passed legislation to allow the homes to be able to have reimbursement rates not tied to Medicare. So would you consider such a legislation going forward this year? And so we can really get to the crust of what your bill, you claim you wanted to do today, which is wages, since safety is already an issue and not an issue rather because of it's highly regulated.
Jury Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, personally, I am open to any set of measures that we could pass that would help better fund the long-term care industry, make sure that we have the best care possible for seniors, and to make sure that not only we're paying a reasonable wage so that we can compete in the service industry, but so that people have a reason to stay committed to this work for years on end, that they can support themselves and their families through doing this work. It is the most important work in our society to care for the vulnerable, and we pay them like it is the least important work. Frontline workers, including nursing home workers, and I'm not blaming the industry, I'm just saying this is a fact, are among the lowest paid people in our society, and yet we say they are the most essential. And without giving workers a seat at the table to negotiate, to have a voice, to set standards, which this bill offers, they will be left behind. That is the history of our economy for the last generation. Workers who don't have power because they're not part of a union or they're not highly educated and specialized get left behind, and we have millions of left behind workers in the state, and we need to start doing something to solve that problem. More money from the state will help, but more importantly, empowering workers helps the most.
Representative Donald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I do recognize, and I think many of my colleagues do, that in especially the trades unions, where the safety compliance and the safety training is very important, our industry, the industry of the nursing home, is very highly regulated, and safety training is of the most importance. But when you say millions of people are left behind because they're not union, where do you get that data? In what industries are you insinuating that millions of people are left behind? And when you say left behind, what do you mean by that?
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm talking about the fact that the data is a little bit old now, but I don't think it's dramatically inaccurate. 40% of jobs in Minnesota pay less than a living wage, and the fastest growing job sectors are the least paid. And by the way, there is, it should be noted that new Americans, people from historically disadvantaged groups, fill a lot of those jobs. And so what are we doing? We are leaving people behind because they don't earn enough to support themselves if it's not a living wage. That's what I'm referring to. And I'm not saying that the nursing home industry is pushing that down, but that is the market pressure that we have seen for so long. And we're seeing some wage increases now. That's positive. COVID has shifted this dynamic somewhat, but in the long run, the power of companies, the power of management to push down wages has made it much more of a struggle for millions of people to get by compared to how things were a generation ago.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then Representative Winkler, based on your comment on that, what are your views on the rate reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I said I'm open to any proposal that would help this industry have more funding and better care for people and provide wages that will allow people to support themselves and stay committed to this work.
Members, I'd like to let you know that I think we're getting a little bit into the weeds for where the purview of this bill falls under Department of Labor and Industry, and we do have a presentation from the commissioner coming up. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Then lastly, with that said, Representative Winkler, I'd be willing to work with you and bringing your words to fruition that we do care about the nursing home workers. And it's very important, I'm sure that you realize that we need to unfreeze, as Toby Pearson said, the circling of the drain. I've worked with him when I was on HHS for 4 years. He's very much of an expert in that field. And we really need to unfreeze the rate reimbursement for those super wealthy that you guys always like to pick on, that don't pay their fair share. They can pay their fair share at a nursing home, but they don't have to. They don't have to because of our law. Therefore, nursing homes are losing money every day. You heard Mr. Pearson say that even 1 month's payment would force a nursing home to close. So if you're willing to commit today or tomorrow, I'll work with you as well that we can pass legislation to unfreeze rate reimbursement so we can get these workers, including many immigrants who are new to our country, and those who are less fortunate to get the pay that they deserve, taking care of the elderly in our nursing homes. Would you be willing to do that, Representative Winkler?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I already said that I'm open to proposals. I'm not ready to commit to you on any particular bill that is outside of this bill today.
Thank you. I'll take that as a yes, and we'll work next week sometime.
Okay, Representative Poston, it's customary to let the lead go of last, so I see your hand is up again real briefly, if you can, because we do have a presentation to do.
This is going to be a very brief question, Chair Eklund. Thank you, and it's for the majority leader. I keep hearing this phrase, living wage. Could you explain that to me?
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, yes, it's the amount of money it takes to have a roof over your head, to have access to health insurance, to pay for childcare if you have children, and to live a basic life of security. It is something that a large share of the jobs in our society do not pay enough to fund.
Yeah. Is there a dollar amount? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Is there, Is there a dollar amount when you look at that living wage that you want to look at or use?
Majority Leader Winkler, before you go, I think this is a conversation that we need to have on the side. I don't think that we're going to discuss. We're going to find out what the exact term of a living wage is in this hearing. Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I would just wrap up and ask for your support for the bill. Representative Post indeed does do a calculation of that based on where you live and what your demographics are, and it is available through that agency.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Representative McDonald, please, quickly.
Thank you. Well, since you said the minority lead gets the last word, I want to get the last word and just remind for the record that unfortunately the DFL did want to cut funding to the nursing homes to the tune of $45 million. That's on record. You can't dispute that fact. So I think that's important to note, since Representative Winkler's bill attempts to give more money to the board to decide wages and rules and regulations and safety, that their actions 2 years ago didn't orchestrate anything close to what his bill suggests he wants to do. $45 million cut to the nursing homes in 2020. So I wanted that to be on record to be noted.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. A lot of parties have done things in the past that probably need to be on record, and that might be one of them. Closing comments, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the time and the discussion today. I appreciate your questions, and I look forward to continuing this conversation as we move on to the Judiciary Committee.
I renew my motion that House File 3405 be referred to Judiciary, Finance, Civil Law Committee. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, no.
Representative McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Frederick, yes. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Yes.
Representative Sundin, yes.
Edelson, yes.
And Representative Edelson, yes. Mr. Chair, we have 7 ayes and 4 nays.
Zhang T, aye, sorry.
Oh, Representative Zhang, aye. Mr. Chair, we have 8 ayes and 4 nays.
With 8 ayes and 4 nays, House File 3405 is on its way to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Next up, we have a presentation of the Governor's 2022 Supplemental Budget for the Department of Labor and Industry. Presenting for the Department will be DLI Commissioner Rosalyn Robertson, holy mackerel. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Robertson. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you very much for inviting me to present the Governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm very pleased to be here with you today. I have a presentation prepared. My staff will be moving my slides. I also have a number of program managers available. I'll try to, in the interest of time, I will try to move as quickly as I can, but I do have additional staff available if there are specific questions. So, again, thank you for giving me this opportunity. Next. Just as a reminder, the Department of Labor and Industry's mission is to ensure Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. Our vision is to be a trusted resource and an impartial regulator for employers, employees, property owners, and other stakeholders. Labor and industry accomplishes its mission and its vision through its operating areas, including the workers' compensation area, which ensures appropriate benefits are delivered to injured workers efficiently and at a reasonable cost. We also administer the Minnesota OSHA plan, which helps keep Minnesota workplaces safe and healthy through the activities of the compliance unit, which includes inspections and investigations, and the voluntary arm of OSHA, which is the consultation program, which offers free voluntary workplace safety and health services. Next, we have the labor standards unit, which protects workers and promote compliance through enforcement and outreach about wage, hour, and employment laws. We have the apprenticeship unit, which promotes and facilitates the development of quality registered apprenticeship programs that help employers recruit, train, and retain a highly skilled and diverse workforce in Minnesota. The unit conducts compliance reviews to ensure the protection and advancement of apprentices training in their areas. We also administer the construction code and licensing. This division protects public health and safety through the enforcement of reasonable and uniform construction standards. It focuses on improving efficiencies in the delivery of inspections, permitting, licensing, and other construction regulatory services to the industry's stakeholders. We also administer the Minnesota Dual Training Pipeline Program, which supports employers in building their own dual training program, strategically combining related instructions with on-the-job training to ensure a skilled workforce. This program targets four high-growth industry sectors, including advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and information technology. We also have the Youth Skill Training Program, which supports the development of partnerships between educators, employers, and community-based organizations to provide students 16 years and older with classroom instructions, safety training, and a paid, meaningful work experience in high-growth, high-demand occupations. And then finally, of course, we have our general support, which performs support functions, including communication, financial services, human resources, legal services, outreach and education, research and statistics, and combative sports. Next. The labor and industry base budget for fiscal year 22-23 is $234.2 million. Of the $234 million base budget, only $9.76 million is general funds. And that includes those funds support the labor standards unit, IT modernization, which will end at the end of fiscal year 2023. The majority of the funds come from the Workers' Compensation Fund and the Construction Code Funds. This pie chart shows expenditures by program. Work comp benefits and CCLD are the largest expenditure areas, accounting for more than 50% of the total spending. Next. Our budget change items include supporting working families, developing a skilled and diverse workforce, protecting safety and health, and mitigating climate change. The Walsh Flanagan budget to move Minnesota forward, invest in working families, and support a skilled workforce. Labor and industry supplemental budget proposals reflect these priorities. The first three initiatives I will present are being introduced as separate bills and as such are not included in the DLI supplemental bill draft. Nevertheless, they are key priorities for the administration. Next. First, the governor recommends $1 billion to provide payment to frontline workers who have sacrificed so much during the pandemic to keep Minnesotans safe, healthy, fed, and cared for. This proposal would provide $1,500 payments to an estimate of 667,000 workers, including healthcare, childcare, school, grocery store, food service, transportation, building service, public safety, retail, and manufacturing employers. These frontline worker payments recognize the essential work of Minnesotans who have risked their health and continue to provide the vital services needed to keep our state running during the pandemic. Next. Next, we have paid family and medical leave. This is a comprehensive paid family and medical leave program that would provide Minnesotans with economic stability, boost the economy, retain workers, and recognize people need to be able to take time off from work to welcome new family members, care for themselves or a sick loved one, to recover from an illness or injury without losing all of their wages. The proposed funding of $536,000 in fiscal year 23 and $995,000 in fiscal year 24 and 25 for labor and industry would address education and compliance costs of the program and support an information technology system upgrades to implement the program. Next. Next slide, please. Can you go back to page 7, please? Okay. Next, the governor recommends funding for a safe and responsible legalization of cannabis for adults in Minnesota. The appropriation of $121,000 to the Department of Labor and Industry would be used to support employers in the legal cannabis industry to build their own dual training programs, which combine structured on-the-job training with formal related education in the statutorily allowed industries, advancing manufacturing, agricultural, healthcare, information technology, all within the Minnesota Dual Training Pipeline Program. Next. I'll briefly summarize Article 1 of the bill, which includes the proposed appropriations to the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'll get into greater detail in the subsequent slides. Article 1 Section 2, Subdivision 3, including the following: labor standards and apprenticeship appropriation. 1.059 million in fiscal year 23 for the Labor Education and Advancement Program, or which stands for LEAP grants. 316,000 for two additional apprenticeship positions, including a director of apprenticeship, and then 1.758 million for prevailing wage enforcement, 196,000 to strengthen the fair labor standards for agricultural and food processing workers, 1.367 million for enforcement duties regarding earned sick and safe time. Section 2, Subdivision 3 includes 747,000 for youth skill training, grants, and program administration. Section 2, Subdivision 4 includes 150,000 base appropriation for the Office of Combative Sports. And finally, Article 1, Section 3 includes 51,000 funding for MMB related activities related to earned sick and safe time. Next. Increasing equity in apprenticeship. The governor recommends 1.375 million operating increase to grow registered apprenticeship in Minnesota to train, reskill, and upskill the state's workforce. A 1.06 million increase to the Labor Education Advancement Program will support and better facilitate the participation and retention of women, people of color, and Indigenous people in registered apprenticeship programs and employment in careers that pay a family-sustaining wage. The remaining 316,000 would support two new positions within the apprenticeship unit, including a director of apprenticeship. In total, the request would fund three new positions. Presently, a single individual directs the Registered Apprenticeship and Labor Standards Program. Due to significant growth in these program areas, each unit needs its own director to achieve its statutory objectives. Minnesota has experienced growth in its apprenticeship program over the last several decades. In 1997, Minnesota had 4,667 apprentices. Today, Apprenticeship Minnesota reports 11,000 registered apprentices in eight industries. There are 194 active apprenticeship sponsors and more than 2,300 participating employers. These numbers will continue to grow given the demand of skilled workers. Previous funding used to provide $200,000 that was split between two community-based organizations. While the current funding have been cut by 50%, the funding now is split between five organizations. Labor and industry currently receive $100,000 from the Workforce Development Fund for LEAP to distribute grants to these five organizations for amounts ranging between $12,000 and $30,000 per year. Current grantees have expressed to the agency that the funding is insufficient to establish meaningful programming to support women, people of color, and Indigenous people in registered apprenticeship opportunities. By increasing this funding and broadening eligibility, the agency will award larger grants to more organizations, expanding LEAP's reach across the state. Funding will enable community-based organizations and nonprofit organizations and tribal governments to implement support and improve programming participation, retention, the completion of women, people of color, and indigenous people in high-wage registered apprenticeship career opportunities. Next. Minnesota is estimated to receive more than $6 billion in federal funding during the coming years, much of which will be used for public infrastructure projects covered by prevailing wage laws. Prevailing wage laws exist in Minnesota to ensure projects funded with public money be constructed and maintained by the best means and highest quality of labor reasonably available, and that persons working on public work projects be compensated according to the real value of the services they perform. A proposed base increase of $1.758 million each year would fully fund the current prevailing wage staff employed by the department, as well as adding additional staff necessary to provide education and enforcement to ensure our tax dollars are not promoting exploitative practices such as wage theft. Next. The Youth Skill Training Program supports the development of partnerships among school districts, employers, and community-based organizations to offer safe, healthy, and meaningful work experiences for 16 and 17-year-olds. This proposal increases the grant funding by $500,000 each year and provides additional resources for staff needed to administer the program. By growing youth skill training, more student learners will be better equipped to enter the workforce and select a course of education to contribute to their career path, and more employers would have the skilled workers that they so desperately need. Next. Returning to the language of the bill, Article 2 includes policy and technical language for the department budget proposals. Sections 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, and 8 are technical cleanup to establish a separate division of labor standards and a division of apprenticeship. Presently, a single individual directs both registered apprenticeship and labor standards program. Due to significant growth in these program areas, each need their own director to achieve the statutory objectives. Years ago, around the mid-2000s, after seeing several years of a contracting budget, the tough decision was made to combine the units. Both units have since recovered to a degree and have expanded their responsibilities and the need to support the workforce development. Now that the units have seen some growth, it no longer makes good business sense to have these combined units. It is critical that both units have its own management and its own director. Section 6 of Article 2 expand the scope of the LEAP grants to include facilitating not only the participation, but the retention of the targeted populations in registered apprenticeship. It broadens grant eligibility to nonprofit organizations and Minnesota tribal governments. Section 9 broadens the construction code and licensing jurisdiction to assisted living facilities. And section 10 includes the commercial energy code improvements, which I will discuss later. Section 11 corrects an error from last session that continued fee reductions for licensing, building permits, and plan reviews for 2 years. While the fiscal tracking was correct and reflected the full $4.5 million revenue reduction for fiscal year 22 and 23, last year's bill only addressed the license fee reduction. Section 11 of the bill provides the extension of lower building permit and plan review fees, which was intended by the legislature and labor and industry, retroactive to October 1st, 2021. DLI has continued to assess the lower fees as intended. We appreciated receiving a letter of intent from Chair Eklund, Senator Rarick, and Senator Pratt, which agreed with the agency's course of action. Section 12 of Article 2 adds effective dates for the cleanup provision within the Workers' Compensation Council bill, which was passed earlier this session. The prior law passed without effective dates recommended by the council and without this addition of an effective date of the day following that enactment, the provisions wouldn't be effective until August 1st of 2022. Next. This proposal gives the agency regulatory oversight of assisted living facilities and assisted living with dementia care facilities licensed by the Department of Health. This proposal would enable labor and industry to provide construction code reviews and inspections statewide to ensure these facilities that are designed for the elderly and vulnerable meet the minimum safety standards. Assisted living facilities and assisted living with dementia care facilities are the only remaining types of housing in Minnesota serving vulnerable adults that is not currently under labor and industry jurisdiction. Next. Since 2005, greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15%. Partially driven by higher heating and cooling demands caused by changing climate. The governor recommends $145,000 every 3 years to institute an adoption framework for the statewide commercial building code that ensures all new commercial and large multifamily construction is net zero by 2036. Next, Article 3 of the bill provides for OSHA penalty conformance. One of the core criteria of having a state plan state requires that that state plan state be at least as effective as federal OSHA. Minnesota OSHA is currently not considered to be at least as effective. Minnesota OSHA needs to align the penalties with federal OSHA penalties. The governor recommends conforming federal maximum penalties and tie-in future penalties to inflation. Conformity would ensure continued federal funding and would encourage employers to take workplace safety and health more seriously and do more to keep workers safe. Next. Article 4 of the bill which will be introduced as a standalone bill so that it can make the needed additional committee stops, strengthens fair labor standards for agricultural and food processing workers. The governor recommends $196,000 in fiscal year 23 and $146,000 each year thereafter to strengthen existing workplace protections for agricultural and food processing workers so a greater number of these workers are protected and aware of their workplace rights. This recommendation is among those made by the Committee for Safety, Health, and Well-being of Agricultural and Food Processing Workers to improve housing, safety, and labor standards for these workers. Article 4 amends the Packing House Workers' Bill of Rights. It strengthens the migrant labor law and amends the recruitment and food processing employment standards. The provisions amend employee notice requirements so they are provided in a language that the worker prefers, increase penalties for noncompliance, and expands the department enforcement authority over these laws. Next. Article 5 and 6 are the earned sick and safe time provisions in the proposed budget. This language mirrors language in House File 7, the first engrossment authored by Representative Olson. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted for us how critically important it is for people to stay home from work when they are sick. Workers who go to work sick risk spreading illnesses to co-workers, customers, and the public. Too many Minnesota employees don't have access to earn sick and safe time and are forced to choose between going to work sick or not being able to support their family by earning an income. This proposal would ensure workers can accrue up to 48 hours a year of earned sick and safe time, but when they need to recover from an illness, go to a medical appointment, care for a child during school closures, or get care or assistance due to any other medical issue. A proposed $1.367 million in fiscal year 23 and $3.724 million in fiscal year 24-25 would fund outreach efforts, enforcement, and compliance activities. Next. Article 7 of the bill includes statutory changes to the Office of Combative Sports to better protect combatants' health and safety. As with the agricultural and food processing proposal, this article will also be introduced as a standalone bill so that it can make needed additional committee stops. Proposed changes improve the Office of Combative Sports oversight of combative sports contests. It clarifies the grievance procedure, address inconsistencies in statutory language, and close regulatory loopholes that put combatants' health and safety at risk. A proposed annual general fund appropriation of $150,000 would supplement fee revenue to fully support the program. Changes include restructuring the advisory council to meet the current and future needs by decreasing the size of the council and giving the commissioner the ability to appoint individuals that have various areas of combative sports expertise, not limited to boxing or mixed martial arts. It will improve event security by requesting all combative sports contests have at least one uniformed security guard or off-duty law enforcement officer present to ensure the safety of staff, combatant, and spectators. It will protect combatants' health by requiring an ambulance and two emergency medical technicians be present at all combative sports contests. It will ensure contest promoters pay a proportionate amount in fees relative to the event size by limiting the number of complimentary tickets that can be issued to 15% of the total attendance. It will close loopholes that allow individuals to avoid regulations and put combatants' health and safety at risk by requiring that combative sports not directly regulated by the Office of Combative Sports be regulated by a third party to ensure basic health and safety protocols are in place. The agency is requesting a general fund base appropriation for the Office of Combative Sports because the fees raise inadequate revenue to fully support the program. Increasing fees is not an option, as this would decrease the number of sports events occurring in Minnesota, which would further decrease revenues. In 2013, labor and industry and the legislature increased combative sports license fees for promoters, combatants, and officials in an effort to raise their required revenue. As a result of these fee increases, fewer promoters, combatants, and officials sought licenses here in Minnesota. There were fewer events, and the overall revenue decreased. In 2019, labor and industry and the labor legislature lowered license fees for combative sports officials to align with our surrounding states. It increased the number of licensed combative sports officials and allowed additional events to be held in Minnesota. With that, Chair Eklund, this concludes my prepared presentation. Me and my staff are available to take any questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Robertson. Members, we have about 8 minutes left in committee. I need to remind you that this is an overview from the department, and the bill will be dropped, and we'll have a number on it Thursday, and then we can get into the real details of it. Commissioner, Representative McDonald.
Well, maybe, Commissioner, someday. You never know. God works in mysterious ways. See, I guess I hear you, Mr. Chair, and I'll honor and respect that we'll have an opportunity to ask questions in the future. But I do have a question for the commissioner. Well, I had something funny to say about the combative sports. I doubt they need security guards or off-duty policemen. Have you seen them fight? I mean, they can take care of themselves. But anyway, I digress. In regarding the apprenticeship, and I'll just ask this one question, Mr. Chair, in lieu of time, because I have a son that's an apprentice for a plumbing company and heating and air conditioning. I'm just curious how those funds are used and how they get to the employers who offer apprenticeship. I guess I don't know as much as about it as I should.
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the Department of Labor do not fund individual employers. The funding that is being sought would support community-based organizations that work with their communities to introduce and share information about registered apprenticeship. It would be used to help support and continue to drive registered apprenticeship by making more individuals aware of it and help them in terms of providing some of the baseline support that is often needed when you are introducing registered apprenticeship. some of the funding that the majority of the funding that is requested, as I indicated, is for LEAP grant funding. That is Labor Education Advancement Program. This is a program that was funded at the federal level in the late 60s when the Federal Department of Labor phased out that funding. The Minnesota legislature was lobbied to pick up that funding. They did pick it up and they continued to provide the funding at the same rate that federal labor had provided the funding. However, as the years rolled on, that funding was decreased by 50%. Additionally, there was a court decision that prohibited labor and industry from awarding this funding to two single community-based organizations. We were directed to open it up to the competitive process. Since this funding originated, it's been cut in half and the competition has increased significantly. These funds are provided directly to those community-based organizations that have workforce development programs that provide things to their clientele. It could be personal protective equipment. It could be a bus card. It could be boots. It could be gloves. It could be a number of support that help ready those prospective employees to enter into registered apprenticeship.
Representative McDonald, and if you don't mind, Representative McDonald, Representative Nelson has a comment on the apprenticeship program too, so I'm not cutting you off, but I just let him comment and then I'll come back to you if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. And Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to say, Representative McDonald, the question you asked about the plumber's apprenticeship program, it's similar to the carpenter's apprenticeship program that a few years ago, I went through and graduated from. I won't say how many years ago that was. But anyway, that's paid for by the membership of the union. It's paid for part of their paycheck. There's usually some amount set aside to fund their apprenticeship program. So it's totally funded by the apprenticeship, by the industry and the union itself.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson. I appreciate that. Then just lastly, I just want to ask the commissioner in her slide regarding the frontline workers payers bill, the $1 billion. You said that the check will go to, either I misunderstood you or you misspoke, it'll go to manufacturers, employers.
Commissioner Robertson.
You know, when you listed out the large different career that will get it in different factions. You said manufacturers, employers. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, no, that is not correct. The funds would go to the named industries, including manufacturing workers, not employers. If I said employers, it was a misstatement.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all for now.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Commissioner. I'm sorry we had to not give you enough time, but I'm glad we got through this. And next week or the week after, we'll have lots of time to pick through this bill as we present it on its own. So thank you, Commissioner, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any comments or questions, members? Okay, I have one before we close. I do my absolute best to make sure that the final question goes to the lead or final comment goes to the lead. And with some of the times that we're taking on this thing, once I go through the members and I go to the lead, I will not be going back to the other members just because another question popped into your head. So I do my best to make sure the leads have the last word after the bill presentation. Wednesday, March 9th, we're gonna have presentations from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Military Affairs on the governor's 22 budget. And we are also going to have Representative Fredericks, House File 3379 up on Wednesday. Any other final comments or questions, members? Seeing no hands, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.